Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben.
Ben, today's topic is one that I have just a tiny little bit of experience with, but not a whole lot. It's kind of something that, I saw it in a friend's car one time.
Oh, okay.
But I've never owned one of these devices myself.
That's weird, because you have such a checkered past. I just assumed that you would need to have one of these.
No. Now, I don't have any experience bypassing them either, but we're talking about kill switches, and we're talking about kill switches in vehicles in particular, because there are other types of kill switches, right?
Right, yeah. A kill switch is, at its most basic level, simply something that will prevent a device, whether that device is a car, a smartphone, a Kindle, what have you, from working, from turning on.
Yeah. And it's not to be confused with some of the other stuff that is installed from the factory in cars. Now, I know that there are things that are similar to this. I mean, the idea is the same.
Right.
It's a different execution of the whole thing. So we're talking today mostly about aftermarket kill switches, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these are things that you would simply hide in your vehicle as a security measure. You park your car, you know, wherever you are, and then you reach into the secret nook or cranny and hit the off switch.
Mm-hmm. Or step on the switch, or, switch on the heater to a certain level and the radio station to a certain station. There's all kinds of crazy ways to, you know,
to trip the switch.
Yeah, to trip these, I guess. That's a good way to say it, Ben. So we're not talking about like the factory installed,
like security locks or anything. No.
Yeah, like the immobilizer systems, you know, where like the RFID systems that use the chip and the key and in the ignition. And if it doesn't match up, it only runs for a couple seconds, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily what we're talking about. We're talking about more like, what we just described with the switches and, the interrupt systems, whether it's fuel system, whether it's electrical system. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of different types. And another thing that we don't want to confuse these with are some of the other anti-theft devices. And, you know, they all work together, I guess, in combination if you want. You could use any combination of these. Steering wheel locks, like kind of like the club. Which you can get for about $100 or something like that. You could have an aftermarket alarm installed or a factory installed alarm. That's, that could be anywhere from $100 up to about $1,000 if you do it aftermarket. Or if you add it onto your vehicle, I think is an option.
Yeah. Another similar thing that people do that's not quite a kill switch would be like a battery disconnect switch, which, some people recommend if you have an electrical short in your car, which we were talking about this earlier, those can be difficult to find. Some people, for less than $50, you can get a battery disconnect switch that you just turn off when you've stopped your car.
You know what? I would go so far as to say that is a kill switch. I think that something.
You think so?
Yeah. If you were to leave, you could run one of those to the cabin of the vehicle. Now I see them in race cars occasionally. They're mounted on the outside for safety personnel to come out, and it's a great big red handle that you can turn with, a lightning bolt on it.
Right.
These should not be so,
that
so
visible.
Obvious. That's right. So obvious. So right out there because, the idea is to disable the vehicle without allowing a potential car thief to be allowed to grab your car. So you don't want to label it. You don't want to have it out, right out in the open.
Right.
But I would say that a kill switch like that, I would call it a kill switch, the battery disconnect. If you hide it, I mean, they're not going to be able to start the vehicle if you have that, activated, right?
Yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's just another way that a kill switch would work.
Yeah, I guess
okay.
So. I mean, because when we talk about it, when we're saying kill switch, I guess what you and I are probably thinking of today, and we'll get on the same page on this, I'm sure, as we talk about it. We're talking about either starter or I guess maybe ignition interrupt.
Yes.
Is what the basic thing is. Mm-hmm. And or there's another type, which is it interrupts the signal to the ECU, which then can prevent fuel from flowing to the engine. So it's either electrical or fuel that is shut off with this switch.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that will primarily, as you said, be associated with theft or the theft prevention, but not always, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, because people get around the system, and I'll tell you, I've got something here that I want to include near the end. That they call themselves the best anti-theft system on the market right now. And when I say right now, they've got decades of history. So I would like to tell you about that as we get to the end of the podcast. But there's one that has a pretty good track record.
Yeah? Yep. All right. Well, we always like to set up something to happen at the end of the show. So let's get into, let's get right into it with some statistics. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. Now I've got some older statistics that are going to set you up for some newer ones that you have. In 1991, that was the peak of auto theft, right? According to the FBI. You already know the answer to this, so I won't ask you to pretend to guess. 1.66 million vehicles stolen just in the United States.
What year was that? 1991?
Uh-huh.
We've talked about this in the past. I know we have. Yeah. When we're talking about new car sales maybe or something like that, or maybe it was Chop Shops or something.
It was a Chop Shop episode.
Yeah, and I cannot figure out why 1991 was such a big year for car theft.
What was the spike?
It is a huge spike. It's way, way out of the ordinary, so I don't know. I mean, I really have never found one good explanation as to why 91 was the peak year in car theft.
Yeah, I don't know either. And I looked at this. It is a conundrum, and I think it has to be a perfect storm of a couple of different things. But remind me, were these the Honda years? Was this when the Honda was the most commonly stolen car?
Likely, but I think that's sort of still true.
Yeah, it kind of is, yeah. And if you want to learn more about why that is true, and why is it the Honda Civic or the Accord?
Right now it's the Accord, and the Civic, I'm sure, is up there. It's always up there.
They're so neck and neck,
always.
So if you'd like to learn why these two vehicles have the dubious distinction of being the most often stolen car in the U.S., check out our Chop Shop episode. But here's another thing. A funny thing happened in 2011. Reported thefts dropped from 1.66 million in 91 to just over 700,000.
Okay, so this is, 10 years later?
10 years later.
Oh, no, 20 years later. That's 20 years, right? 91 to 2011.
Oh, my gosh.
20 years. Can you believe that?
We're getting old.
Every time I hear a number like that, I can't believe it. Like, okay, 1991 was, oh, my gosh, it was 24 years ago now?
Yeah, I am still accidentally writing 13 instead of 15 on checks.
13.
Yeah. And I'm writing checks.
13 instead of 15. So you're more than a year behind.
Ah, yeah. It's hard to say goodbye to yesterday,
it's,
I guess.
Difficult to be you.
Oh, man.
All right. So I've got a couple of updated stats if you want to go there.
Because yes.
I have the, and when I say updated, here's what I mean. These are the most stolen new and used cars in America as of 2013. And the reason we only have 2013 numbers is because the 2014 numbers haven't been compiled yet.
Right.
And it will be a significant amount of time before that happens, because I'll tell you, the 2013 stats came from an article in Forbes in around, I think it was August of 2014. So it takes a long, long time for all this to be compiled in one place and then have an accurate number, an accurate representation of where they came from. So the top five vehicles. I'm only going to give you the top five because they list the top 10 as far as all model years taken during 2013, and then also the top 10 from new vehicles only from the 2013 model year. So I'll give you just the top five from all model years taken during 2013.
All right.
All right. So the first one is, I'll tell you the number five. Okay. Number five is the Toyota Camry at 14,420.
Ouch.
This one is not unexpected. The Ford F-150 is at number four with 26,494, and that's one of the top-selling vehicles. So you know,
right?
That's gonna be up
yeah,
there.
That makes sense.
The Chevy Silverado, again, not really unexpected. 27,809 were stolen in 2013.
Wow!
And then the two that you mentioned, the Honda Civic comes in at number two at 45,001, and then the Honda Accord is number one at 53,995. So that's a significant amount of vehicles. Again, that's just the top five.
Right.
And that was all model years. Now, if you go to just brand new vehicles, if someone, you know, had just brought this home from the dealership or, you know, months before or whatever, you know, it's a relatively new vehicle. And I won't list all the numbers here, but, the top five are the Chevy Impala, the Toyota Corolla, the Ford F-150, which comes in at number three again, the Ford Fusion, and then the Nissan Altima was number one in 2013.
That I did not see coming.
Yeah, I didn't either, but apparently it's a big seller, and if there are a lot of them out there, it means that thieves are going to, target that vehicle as well. And that's an important point to make, is that you don't have to drive a fancy, flashy, brand new vehicle in order for it to be, you know, picked up by a thief.
Right. Yeah, there are two big risk that you kind of take on when you are driving a new and very popular vehicle. The first is that thieves who want to be inconspicuous are more likely to steal a car that does not stick out.
Yeah, that's true.
The second part, maybe the more important part, is that cars that have great sales numbers are going to be cars that need component parts. So people who work at a chop shop are much, much more likely to steal an Altima that they know they can chop into a bunch of components and just send off to unscrupulous mechanics.
Yeah, sure. The parts are worth more than the whole.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Because of availability. People want the parts from that 2013 Nissan Altima, apparently. Mm-hmm. And that car becomes very valuable when it's broken into pieces rather than just sold as one complete piece, because they know it's a hot car already. So they're trying to sell it, and they're going to get low dollar amount for that. But for the parts, that's easier to disguise and distribute.
Yeah, and you can sell a part without a VIN.
Yeah, most parts.
Most parts.
Yeah, and they're getting better at that. They're trying to improve tracking on stuff like that. So that's kind of going away, but not entirely.
So how do you avoid, ladies and gentlemen, having your Accord, your Civic, your Silverado, and so on stolen from the parking lot, and you were just gone for 20 minutes? How do you prevent that from happening? The answer might be a kill switch.
Yeah, and this can be so simple. It can just be an interrupt in the ignition circuit.
Sure.
As long as you hide that switch, as long as you can hide that little toggle switch or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You don't put it on the dash and don't write,
kill switch.
Yeah, kill switch or ignition interrupt or fuel shutoff or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Don't clearly identify what it is. You can hide it just about anywhere.
Write something boring like income tax.
Yeah. a switch with that's labeled income tax.
Look, we're just brainstorming here, but you make a great point, because you could put this in the trunk. You could put this in the glove box. The only limit on this is really how much work you want to put in.
Yeah, as long as you're comfortable wiring in your vehicle. Now, it's not really even that difficult. I mean, it's just a simple matter of interrupting the ignition wiring and rerouting this switch somewhere else, so that when the switch is on, then you're able to use the key to start the vehicle. It's as easy as that. It really is. It's so simple. You can do it in 10 minutes. It could take you an hour. It could take you a weekend. However complex you want to make this is how difficult it will be, really. It can be very, very simple. And there are lots of online guides out there that will help you to determine where to put these things or how to position them or how to make them so that you're not going to inadvertently shut it off as you're driving, something like that.
Which can happen.
And
it is dangerous.
Even more important, I don't know if you can even get around this. If you're going online to search for the best place to put a kill switch, it means the thieves are going online to look for the best place to put a kill switch as well. So be creative with this.
Right.
Figure out where is somewhere in your vehicle that is relatively inaccessible that you wouldn't think to look. It's not a common place. It's not just, right under the dash where you can reach under with your hand and find
it.
Again, not on the dash, not anything like that. Make it a little difficult to find. And this kind of plays into, remember I said I have just very little experience with this?
Yes.
At the beginning? I had a friend in high school who had a kill switch in his car, and it was kind of a cool thing. And I don't really know why it was there. It was an older vehicle. It was a little bit beat up, kind of rough around the edges, had a huge engine in it. It was a fun car to drive.
Yeah.
So I think it was just an add-on thing. But the kill switch was below the carpet, on the floorboards, accessible to the driver. So you'd have to, put your heel onto this thing and press it. And then, then the ignition would work. The problem was, after years of using this thing, the carpet began to become worn out over top of the kill switch. And it became very evident that you had to put your foot right where it was. So if he said there's a kill switch in the carpet, you would know right where it is. I guess if you were to jump in and look at it, you might not understand what that worn spot was. But to me, it stood out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, he could cover it with a floorboard or something, maybe.
You mean with a mat?
Floor mat, yeah.
A floor mat? You could, I guess. I think the location was odd. It wasn't where it could be covered with a floor mat.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't like when the floor mat wears out, you could just put a new one down.
So
and it's fine.
Really stuck out.
It was in the actual carpet of the vehicle.
Man.
Not the add-on floor
mat.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's about the only experience I have with it. I never wired one, never did anything other than that, than occasionally get in and have to kick that thing to start it if I was driving his car somewhere.
I've seen them on some of my buddy's older cars growing up, but these were like the never-ending project cars where the guy clearly says, well, I probably should work on this transmission, but today I'm going to do something fun.
Today I'm going to put those stereo speakers in.
Oh yeah, it's always the speakers,
it's
right?
It's always that. Yeah, exactly right.
So the question then for you as a car owner becomes, is is a kill switch worth my time? I say, now, Scott, you and I don't have kill switches in our cars.
No.
But I would say it's worth it if you are so inclined and you have the time.
Yeah, I think so, especially if you have a vehicle that you, I mean, a unique vehicle, a very expensive vehicle that, you know, if someone grabs it and takes it out for a joyride, it's done for. If it's a vehicle that you can replace, you know, with insurance or whatever,
right,
you might be less apt to do something like this than if you have a one of a kind vehicle, or if you have a vehicle that's special to you in some way, like let's say it was your father's car or something like that, that you've been holding on to and restoring or whatever. And you want to make sure that vehicle doesn't go anywhere without you. This would be a great device to have.
Can we segue into something slightly related?
Of course we can. Yeah.
Okay. One of the coolest things about kill switch technology, maybe one of the most big brotherish scary things, is that people don't have to be in the vehicle physically touching the switch to trip it.
Ah, yes. Okay. Now, this is a point of contention with a lot of people that have recently purchased vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Those who may have less than perfect credit, maybe.
That's sure.
That's maybe a good way to say it.
Yeah.
Someone who has difficulty borrowing money.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best. Let's leave it at that.
We'll leave it
but,
at that.
But so let's say that you don't have the greatest credit score and you go into a dealership and you want to buy a vehicle and they say, well, you got a pretty low credit score, or maybe, I guess we're willing to take a risk on this because you have had a job for a couple of years and, you know, we're seeing the right trend here.
Right.
We would like to trust you. However, we're going to install this device that will allow us to shut off the ignition if you fail to make a payment.
Right. So if you, for some reason or another, fall behind, then one day you hop in your car and click, 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 nothing.
Yeah, it does not start. And this is just the generic term, I guess, for this would be a starter interrupt device. And I think there's some brand names of this thing that, you know, can be thrown out there as well. And we'll talk about one in particular in just a little while. But in just, like, I guess the most basic way to say this, in the most generic terms, is that if necessary, as you said, Ben, they can remotely disable the ignition. And this scares a lot of people because the idea is that you could be driving down the road and it could shut off. Well, that's not necessarily true. That doesn't happen that way. Now, I know there have been claims.
It won't start.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
So if it's running, it will continue running. If it's stopped, they can disable it and it could be, you know, it could be, an anchor right there where it is. It's not going anywhere.
Right. It's bricked.
Exactly. Yeah. Bricked. That's the term I'm looking for. But a lot of people have the idea that, you know, the dealer is just going to randomly shut this off when you're on the highway, you know, cruising at 70 miles an hour or whatever. That's not the way that this thing works. It just doesn't work that way. And I know there have been claims in the past of things like that happening. And there have even been some payouts, and we'll talk about one of those in just a minute here. But I don't understand how that happened. I don't understand why they got to the point of the payouts. Maybe the technology was such back then that, you know, that was possible. But now it is not. It kind of works the way that a remote starter works. And you have to follow me on this for just a second because there's a lot of safeties in place for something like a remote start system. And I remember that some of them were like, if the hood is open on the car, the remote start won't work.
Mm-hmm.
If the vehicle's not in park, the remote start won't work.
If the door's open, the remote start won't work.
Exactly right. There's all kinds of parameters that have to be met in order for this thing to work. Now, I know that the newer systems use GPS. They understand that the vehicle's stationary. There's also a way, you know, that they can say, well, this parameter isn't met. You know, the vehicle's in motion. The vehicle's not in park. The vehicle is, it's traveling down the road at 70 miles an hour. We can't do it at this point.
Right, yeah.
But at the next possible point, I'll alert you. And, yes, you can use this system, this interrupt system.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Now, what's interesting about this is that, as you said, it's very, very controversial thing because there are people who are complaining. And if you're a Google search away from all sorts of horror stories about this stuff going wrong, people have claimed that their car did stop while it was running. Mm-hmm. And just bricked on them.
Sure.
People have claimed that they have been wrongfully bricked, you know, that they're the checks in the mail, for lack of a better phrase, and that they have been temporarily switched off as a reminder, which is...
That's not the way it works, though. I can tell you that.
I know.
I know you know. But the way that the contract is laid out now, I'm not going to say that there's not an unscrupulous dealer out there that has done this for whatever reason. I don't know if it's vindictive reasons or whatever. I'm not going to say that that's even happened once, but there's always that chance, right?
Right. And you always have to be conscious when you hear people's stories about something going wrong in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to be conscious that there may be part of the story that they're conveniently editing.
Sure. But I'm telling you that the devices today, the modern devices, are built with safeties in mind that allow for certain parameters to be met, like we mentioned before, so that none of this really happens. You know,
right.
It's not shut off in the middle of the interstate, or it's not shut off when you're sitting in traffic or anything like that. So I could tell you about a brand name device that is one of these things, and it kind of runs steps through the codes that happen and the process and the way that the shutdown happens, and it'll give you a better idea of, or a better understanding of how this whole thing works. So the device is called the OnTime device, and it's simple to search. You can find it online. It's called OnTime device. I think there's even an ontimedevice.com that will lay it all out for you. The modern device costs about $250.
Okay.
And dealers don't install it on every single vehicle. It's just the ones that they're concerned about. These people with credit issues.
Sure. Right? And the risky loans. And these can install on any vehicle.
Yes, that's right. And so, you know, it's not just auto dealerships who request this. It's also finance companies, you know, that say, well, we'll allow that loan, but install one of these and then we're all set. And then after the term of the loan, we remove that device, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I hope it comes off.
And in theory, as long as the person is paying their car note on time, they'll never even know this device is there.
Oh, exactly right. It should be just working behind the scenes, and there shouldn't really be any kind of issue with this. Now, there's actually four pieces of information on the OnTime software that have to be programmed ahead of time. And those four things are the first, I'm getting this from ontimedevice.com.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing that they program in is the first payment due date. Then they program in the total number of payments. Then the payment cycle, which is either weekly, biweekly, monthly, semi-monthly, however they do it. And then also, this is interesting, the number of grace days allowed. Now, the grace days come into play in just a minute here as we talk about it. But the OnTime software generates a customer's payment schedule and then assigns a unique 6-digit code for every scheduled payment date. Now, I know we just said that, you know, this should hopefully operate without them even knowing. Actually, on this specific system that I'm talking about right now,
it'll tell you.
You have to enter the 6-digit code after you make your payment and it has been received.
Oh, I see.
So it's a monthly thing. If it's not updated monthly, they send you the code. So here's what happens. If you don't receive your code, the LED codes in the vehicle that you can see and tells you kind of how you stand with your lender.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is the way it goes. On the day that the payment is due, the LED will go from flashing green to flashing red. So it'll let you know that the payment is due right away. And all right, so there's this grace period that we talked about, right? When you have 3 days left in the grace period, whatever period the dealer determines to be, you know, the period for that, the last 3 days, the LED begins to flash three times intermittently to alert the customer that they only have 3 days left to make the payment. So it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
It's three flashes, 3 days.
Sure.
The next day, same thing. Two flashes because there's 2 days left. Right? Simple enough to understand, right? On the last day of the grace period, if the customer still hasn't made the payment to the dealer or whoever, the lender, the LED will flash once intermittently, but then will also beep every 4 seconds. So there's an audible alert with this as well. So you get a visual and an audio.
Every 4 seconds, that's got to wear on you.
It really does. And that's the point, is that you can't ignore this thing, right? So the entire day that, you know, the customer is being, you know, visually and through these audible cues, alerted to the fact that they need to make a payment. And once they do that, you know, they call in or however it works out that they've worked out an agreement.
Sure.
Then the dealer will send the 6-digit code to the person and they can, you know, push the buttons for the 6-digit code and it resets itself for another full month. If it doesn't happen, the next time you shut off the vehicle, it's not going to start again.
So let's go to one of the most immediate questions. Do different customers have a different period of grace?
Well, I would think so. I mean, I'm not entirely sure, but I would think that people have different grace periods based on their credit history. So, you know, somebody who has never had a problem before, they may have a more lenient grace period. Mm-hmm. And somebody who has issues with this type of thing, they may have a shorter grace period. Now, apparently, with this type of system, there's at least a 3-day grace period.
Okay.
I'm sure that can be programmed in but the LEDs flashing and the audible alerts and all that comes into play no matter what, during the last 3 days of the grace period. So even if it's a week long, mm-hmm. the first 4 days, you're not going to be bothered with this. The last 3 days, it's going to be, you know, the LEDs flashing, the audible alerts, et cetera.
Now, Scott, you and I have read anecdotes where people allege that something went wrong with the device in their vehicle. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily on time, but this sort of device. And we've also seen stuff where people who are privacy advocates say that they don't want to be tracked, right?
Sure.
My problem with those complaints is that you didn't have to buy this car.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
I understand.
Like
yeah.
you opted into it.
Well, I get it. And, you know, there's always going to be the argument that, no, I was in a bad position and I had to buy that car in that particular time frame. And this was the best deal and yeah. what I had to do for my family, et cetera. I get it. I understand all that. But I also think you and I were ones to typically remain on top of things, you know, as far as like, well, it's due. I'm going to pay it when it's due. I'm not going to get into this grace period. I'm not going to allow the system to even get to the point where it's flashing its LEDs at me. Well, hopefully we wouldn't be in the position where we even have to have one of these installed to begin with. Hopefully you don't. But if you do, I mean, for whatever reason, I know bad things happen to good people too. So, you know, maybe that's the case. But you can never rule out any kind of circumstance, I guess every circumstance for every person.
Or maybe this could become the new normal. We know that remote access technology of all sorts is becoming more and more common in every type of vehicle.
Sure.
So it could be common in the future, you know, by the time for anybody listening who has children, let's say under 10 right now, then in 6 years or so when your kids drive their first car or you buy a car or something, it may just be par for the course for it to have one of these locks on it that doesn't come off until you paid the car off.
Well, think about like GM's OnStar system. Mm-hmm. They have access to vehicles remotely, right?
That's true.
We know that they can shut down a vehicle even while it's driving if they wanted to. We've seen that in action before in police chases.
Mm-hmm.
So in really extreme situations, I know they can interact with the vehicle and shut it down. It's possible. We know that that's true. But what if they began to use that? Now, because as far as I know, they don't right now. But what if they began to use that system for something like this, for payment enforcement?
Oh, yeah.
So it's already there. If they wanted to, if they really wanted to, they could use this for, you know, enforcing the idea that, yeah, your payment has to be made by this date. Or we could, I don't know, with that system, I guess they could even call and say, hey, just wanted to see what's going on. Thought you might want to drop by the dealership and maybe write us a little check for whatever it is, $379 for that new Malibu that you're leasing. If you don't show up in 24 hours, we're going to be forced to interrupt your starter, and then we'll send out the repo truck.
Have a great day.
Yeah, have a good day, and and we'll see you at the dealership in 15 minutes because we know you're right next door.
So right now, that remote kill switch is one of the more, I guess, controversial things, but I think it makes sense from a business perspective. Mm-hmm. And let us not be mistaken, still the number one use of a kill switch so far is by car owners themselves to prevent theft.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So the auto dealership thing is relatively marginalized at this point.
I mean,
they do it, and we understand that it's done. We hear about it in the news occasionally, but for the most part, the kill switch is something that, you know, you go to Radio Shack and you buy one and you put it in your vehicle, or Pep Boys, or wherever, you know, the local auto parts store is in your town that, you know, sells the kill switch. And again, just be clever about how you hide these things. Be clever about where you put them, and, mm-hmm. And don't make it too obvious. It's just, it's not worth it. I mean, it makes it so easy to bypass.
Right. Don't make it obvious. And, oh, Scott, I almost forgot. Before we move on, you've got a pretty good specific anecdote about one of these dealership kill switches, right?
I do. And there's a few extra little things thrown in here for people that are outside of this area that may not know this person.
All right.
So all those qualifiers in place. Let me go here with this. All right. So back in the 1960s and early 1970s, there was a guy. His name is Mel Farr. And Mel Farr played in the NFL. He was a running back for the Detroit Lions. And he played his whole NFL career with the Detroit Lions from, I think it was from 1967 till about 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel Farr, when he retired after he played in 1973, he went on to own Ford car dealerships in Detroit, in the Detroit area. It was around 1975 when he opened up his first one. It was called Mel Farr Ford, and it was in Oak Park, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1998, he had amassed something like, it was close to $600 million in this business.
Wow.
So it's a giant business, right?
Yeah.
Very, very popular in the area, at least. And, you know, because he's right there near Detroit selling Ford automobiles, is going to be a big popular dealership.
That's
right?
A good point.
All right. So, in fact, in the United States, it was like the 33rd largest auto dealership in the United States at the time. So this is a big deal, right?
Yeah.
Well, he had at some point some significant legal problems because, he had this controversial system, which turns out was the on-time device that I just talked about, installed. And this is, remember, this is back in maybe like the late 80s, early 1990s, maybe. He installed on-time devices, which prevented the drivers of these leased vehicles from starting if they missed a payment. So after all this is going on, you know, there's a lot of news about this, how people are saying like, the system's malfunctioning, just as we talked about.
Yeah.
It was shutting off on them when they're driving and I can't say with any certainty that that didn't happen. I mean, I know that it's possible, I guess. And especially thinking back to then, you know, what the technology is like back then compared to now.
I see what you're saying, but that doesn't make it probable. It only makes it possible.
I understand. But he had so many complaints about this happening that the vehicle's in motion, and also others that said they were not late with their payments when it was shut off.
That I can believe.
It became a major, major problem. So in June of 2000, the FAR name, because he's already retired at this point. He doesn't even have the dealerships at this point. They're paying out, I think he did have his dealership at that point. So he ran it just for slightly longer than this, but
okay.
He had to pay out to each of his 1,500 customers that had this device installed $200 each for the trouble.
Whoa.
Yeah. So there's actually a payout, you know, that was ordered by the courts for him to pay out, this $200 to each of the 1,500.
A class action
people.
Lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, one little quick side note on this whole thing. If you want to see who this guy was and some of these crazy commercials that he had, because, in the article about him, it says that he kind of gained pop star status almost because of his commercials. And he would dress up in like a superhero outfit with a cape. And he would do this, you know what green screen is. He would fly around, Detroit on these green screens. And it was the most hilarious thing, and it would always invariably end with him landing in his dealership in front of a car, you know, like jumping onto the screen.
Yeah.
And then talking really fast about some great deal on, you know, an early 80s Thunderbird or something like that. It was so funny. And they're just exceptionally poorly made. I mean, at the time, I think they were even corny for the time, and that was in the early 80s. So if you get a chance, just look up, you know, it's Mel Farr, and Farr is spelled with two R's, but Mel Farr Ford, and you'll see some of these just, I don't know, like a car dealership gold commercials. Amazing.
Car dealer. We should do something about dealership commercials one day. I don't know if that would be a full episode, but there's a nuts and bolts in there because one of my favorite things growing up was to watch car dealership commercials because you never know. There's always going to be some crazy guy.
I love the local commercials.
Yeah.
The best, right? And that's exactly what this was. It was a local commercial, but with a name that was recognized nationally. And, you know, people that would join him from the Detroit Lions of the day, you know, like, so Billy Sims would be on there.
Oh, yeah, cameos?
Yeah, he would have cameos with all his NFL buddies and stuff. And they were so poorly acted, and it was, you know, that green screen where, you know, you can see the edges of them are kind of glowing.
Right, yeah.
As he's in front of it. It was hilarious stuff. And some of it was animated. It was just, it was really good. It was funny. So bad commercials.
Speaking of things that are really good, it's time for us to move on to one of the biggest questions that you're probably asking yourself right now. And that is, Scott, Ben, okay, you've converted me, kill switches. I get it. But which kill switch is the best?
Ah, you know what? I've been digging into this because, you know, it seems like every single one of these can be defeated, right? Even the factory systems.
Right. There's a way to get around it if you're in the know.
There is. And, you know, there's a big differentiation to make here between kind of like the amateur thief and then the pro thief.
Right.
And the pro thieves can get around just about anything. They can hack, the factory systems, as a matter of fact. And they have a huge, incentive to do that, to be able to hack a factory system, because think about it. If you can break into one system for, let's say, a brand new BMW or a brand new Mercedes or whatever it happens to be, if you can do that for one vehicle, then you know that you can get into just about any vehicle that BMW makes or any vehicle that Mercedes makes. And that is a huge benefit for them, right? So there's one system out there that I found that has kept the criminals guessing for a long, long time. This is one I hinted at the beginning of the podcast.
Right.
And here's their track record, Ben, just before we talk about this. And we're not selling this by any means, but it will sound like a commercial because it's a great system, I tell you. It's a place out of Las Vegas, Nevada. And this is, if you want to go to their home page, it's called neverhotwired.com. And the device is the Revelco anti-theft device. And the Revelco device, which I'll describe in just a minute, has a 39-year track record of never having a vehicle stolen based on hacking their system.
It has, over the 38, almost 40 years now, they have 4 million installs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So since 1976, they've been doing this, and not one vehicle has been stolen by bypassing their system.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So now that
so
we got
what
that,
is it?
It's relatively simple. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's not. It's also complex. It's a plug that's installed. It interrupts the ignition circuit, and it is a 16-prong plug, I guess, or I don't know how to say this, maybe. There's a receiving side, and then there's also like the male side, which you carry on your keychain. And the male side has 16 pins, and that is unique for every single vehicle. There's no duplicates. Or you know what? There probably are duplicates, but who would ever know, right?
Right.
So what this is a dual circuit engine disabler, and that's how they describe it. And they say that it has a 16-pin dongle style plug, which means you carry the male side on your keychain. It's very small.
Right.
It's just this plug. It's like almost like a soda pop cap or something like that you carry on your about that size. And then the other side is built into your vehicle, right? You know, right near the dashboard. And you know, we said you got to hide these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like someone could easily just jumper this thing, and it would be a piece of cake. Well, with 16 pins, and I'll describe this in just a minute why it's nearly impossible. It's almost impossible. There are thousands of combinations that could be done here. So if you're trying to jumper this thing, you know, between the pins to make it work, which is all it really needs.
Yeah.
It's nearly impossible for them to do. In fact, no one has beat it yet. And I'll tell you a little bit about this thing, I guess. The way that's worked is it's a device that's wired into your car's electrical system, and it has to be done by a professional. You know, you can't really do it yourself. So it's not like something you could buy a kit for and have it work. There's no remote control at all. Just that plug, like we mentioned, that kind of acts like a key, I would guess. I mean, because when you get in the vehicle, you plug this thing in, mm-hmm. then you turn the ignition, then it works.
Right.
Without the plug, I mean, so if the plug is not in place, if you forget it or if you lose it or whatever, this thing won't work. And a lot of people might say, well, that's a problem. But really, if you don't have the key, the car's not going to work either. So if you can remember to keep the two together, your key and the dongle or whatever, maybe that's the safest way of all.
Well, people also, you can order extra plugs.
Yeah.
So if you have more than one driver of a vehicle.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And this is actually pretty popular with commercial vehicles too, right?
Oh, exactly right. And I'll tell you why this thing is so impossible to bypass. It's because the wires are, first of all, the wires are encased in armored steel cable. That's one thing that's not happening in most kill switches, because in most, the wire's interrupted, it's clipped or whatever, and then rerouted somewhere nearby, you know, like maybe 2 feet away. It's so simple for a thief to get under there with a flashlight and look and see the colored pair wires that go between the ignition and the kill switch and just simply wire them back together, and then the car starts. It's a piece of cake, right? So all of the wires on the system are black. There's zero color coding that happens with the system. So you've got 16 pins, all of the wires to it coming to and from it are black.
So there's not really a way to know, and the odds of you lucking out are hilariously small.
Yeah, exactly right. Like we said, there's thousands of combinations, and the idea is that with thousands of combinations, if the thieves do try to jumper the system, you know, between the pins, chances are they're going to get it wrong the first time, and when they do, they're going to short something out, and then likely, you know, if you short something in the ignition, it's likely that the vehicle's not going to run at all. So, you know, the car's stuck there anyway. So it would work in a second way, really. And it just goes to tell you that, you know, this is a really safe system if in 39 years they haven't been defeated yet.
Well, no, there are some asterisks on that. They say no properly installed Revelco system has ever been stolen.
Oh, I wonder what that means, though. I mean, properly installed, because I mean, it's been done by professionals. You can't buy a kit, like I said, to install it yourself, right?
Right. It has to be done by a tech. Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be done by a tech. So it seems to me that the only person that would know that would be a tech that installs it. No one else would know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that it's possible. I don't even think the owner would really know how to bypass that system.
Oh, and most insurance companies also give you a break on your rates if you install one.
Not
which,
bad.
You know, some places do that with any sort of anti-theft device. Mm-hmm. But again, this is not a commercial. This is just the one we found that looked like it had the best track record.
Definitely.
And I will say that you can go to revelco.com, that's with one L, to check out more about this system. And just want to read the first part of the history segment here.
All right.
The Revelco anti-theft device was first sold in Houston, Texas on July 20th, 1976 by Vincent Revel. Earlier that year, Revel drove his brand new 1976 Lincoln Mark IV, which he could not afford, back home to Cranston, Rhode Island to show his father how well he was doing in the drag racing business.
Oh, man.
I think that's a great beginning for his story.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
The Lincoln was stolen, spoiler alert.
Oh, no kidding. And that's probably the birth of this device, right? Wow,
yeah,
interesting.
It is.
Huh. All right, so, man, this is interesting. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, that is one that you can have installed. I don't know the cost on the Revelco switch or anything like that, but it's clearly safe. It's clearly tested.
Yeah.
Over decades, right? But that's not to discount the ones that you can go to, you know, like I said, Pep Boys or AutoZone or wherever.
Sure.
To pick up and install. If you do the install, you do it somewhere that's, you know, discreet, somewhere that's out of the way.
Inconspicuous.
Yeah, there's a very good chance that whoever jumps in your car to try to, you know, quickly go for a joyride or whatever is not going to have a chance at getting your car started, because most car thieves, I read somewhere, and I want to say, and I'm going to just ballpark this because I remember reading it, but I don't have it written down. It's something like, you know, 3 out of 4 car thefts are done by just people that, you know, are looking for a quick buck. You know, they're going to either use that car in another crime. They're joyriding. You know, they're just taking it out for whatever reason, taking a part off of it, something
sure.
like that.
It's not a planned crime.
No, the pro thieves are responsible for, you know, like maybe 25% of the car thefts that mm-hmm. happen.
And they do multiple cars in a night.
Oh, they do. Yeah, they really go for it. So those are the ones that, you know, a simple kill switch like the one you'd find at Pep Boys is not going to do it. You're going to need, you know, more something like the Revelco device or something even more dramatic, you know, something mm-hmm. that you have to get under the hood to activate or, you know, there's lots of variation on this. I mean, that you can go extreme or you can go mild with it. And I guess somewhere in between would probably be the safest.
Yeah, there's a Goldilocks zone there. We are going to go ahead and head out today. We hope that you enjoyed this podcast as much as we enjoyed making it. And we do hope that you will write to us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW, to let us know about your experience with kill switches. Are they overrated? Are they underrated? Should everybody have one? And what do you think about dealerships giving out kill switches to people with less than stellar credit?
I am really interested in this because, you know, it hits the news occasionally here, and there's always this debate over whether it's an ethical thing to do or not. So I'm interested in that, and I want to hear your viewpoints on it.
I'm interested in it as well, especially because I have a pretty strong opinion about this one, Scott. Mm-hmm. You don't own the car yet. You know what I mean?
I understand.
Ah, well, we'll see what everybody else says out there. So if you want to contact us directly and you don't care for the social media, then go ahead and send us an email. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.